scientific assessment group working on this spill. And next to him is Larry Dietrich, whom some of you have met before. Larry is the director of our Division of Environmental Quality and is in charge of our spill response efforts overall. The purpose of this briefing is twofold. One is we'd like to bring you up to date on the spill and the status of the response as of this evening. And second, to set the record straight on some misinformation that has been circulated by Exxon concerning dispersant use. In a moment, I'll ask Larry Dietrich to summarize current developments, but I'd like to take just a minute to set the record straight concerning dispersants and the state's role in approval of those. Exxon has reportedly said that DEC and the Coast Guard prevented them from timely use of dispersants to control the spill. This is false. The state of Alaska did not stop or delay the use of dispersants in the pre-approved area, and I'll explain a bit more about that in a moment. I'd like to say that as a general principle, it is important to go forward from this point and determine how we are going to continue making a response and to make that response as effective as possible. There's no acceptable excuse for failure to initiate appropriate recovery. But we are where we are in the spill, and we need to be pressing forward. We intend to work cooperatively with Exxon in that. We've made some changes managerially in how the decisions about the spill response are discussed and approved, and we intend to continue pursuing that. But we simply can't accept inaccurate representations that distort the reality of this very important situation. On the table over here, there are copies of two things, a press release and a timeline. I think the chronology of events summarizes quite clearly why it is that Exxon's earlier versions of how the dispersant use was carried out or not carried out should really be understood. Let me give you a bit of a summary, though. The timeline, of course, is the most detailed summary of that. The state believes that when mechanical means of recovery can be effective, they are preferable because they don't pose the same potential toxicity risks from having oil dispersed through the water column and having additional chemicals included with the oil. At the same time, we recognize that in some instances, use of dispersants is appropriate. And our policy is that we just look at those on a case-by-case basis and make the choices in light of the resources at risk and the choices available for controlling that risk. One of the things that you will see in the timeline is quick and timely turnaround and decisions by this department to authorize dispersant use. We authorized it during the time when it could have been most effective, and we applied conditions where we believed that resources, such as herring, for example, needed to be protected. There were some problems that we believed needed to be addressed because of difficulties Exxon had in applying the dispersant in an effective manner. You may recall that the first three tests of dispersant were mixed or ineffective in dispersing the oil. On Sunday afternoon following the spill, the Coast Guard gave approval for unrestricted dispersant use in Zone 1. Over 24 hours passed before Exxon conducted a dispersant application. Subsequently, dispersants were applied in a restricted zone without approval. And in the course of that, Coast Guard personnel were inadvertently sprayed with the dispersants, which of course violates the Environmental Protection Agency's regulations. Also, I'd like to call attention to the fact that even using the information supplied by Exxon, there's serious question whether the quantities of dispersant on hand could have been appropriate to treat the spill of this size. About Using the 20-to-1 application rate recommended by Exxon, about 500,000 gallons of dispersant would be required to treat this 10 million gallon spill. On Friday, less than 4,000 gallons of dispersant were available in Valdez. It's important to remember that Friday and Saturday are particularly important times because application of dispersants can be most effective when it's during the first 24 hours. Only 110,000 gallons of this 500,000 gallon amount that would be necessary if Exxon were to have treated the entire spill were available 6 days after the spill began. That's only about a fifth of the amount that Exxon would have needed had it really used dispersants as the first line of defense, which was the suggestion that their recent comments have made. Now, the point of all of this is not to have a fight with Exxon. We all need to get this thing resolved. But hiding the reality of where we are by suggesting that this spill was somehow made use by failure to approve dispersant use seems to me to be inexcusable, and we simply should not accept it. I've asked Brad to join us up here because I thought you might appreciate a very brief discussion of how these zones work and what dispersant application really means in a biological sense. We won't take much time for that explanation, but we would be happy, of course, to have Brad entertain any questions that you might have. Brad?
Well, to discuss a controversial issue such as dispersants in a couple of minutes is a pretty good task, but we'll see what we can do. In a simple sense, dispersants are fairly harsh soap. The action of the dispersant is to break the oil up so that it reduces its stickiness and loses the interfacial tension that oil has, and allows it to dissolve into the water column in real small droplets if you have energy to force this to happen. By doing that, you can reduce the shoreline impacts and the impacts to surface-oriented wildlife, and as a result, you may have increased impacts into the organisms of the water column itself. But the big gain is the reduced impacts to the shoreline. Dispersants have never been applied to a spill on large scale of this size, so this was really an untested event. And we ended up applying in the neighborhood of about 23,000 gallons of dispersants here. We're doing a broad resource assessment study, and we'll hopefully be able to identify what impacts resulted from that application, as well as the application of the oil to the water surface. And I'm confident that that will be able to be done with the expertise that we have assembled, and both from Exxon and with the science group that we have. Just to cover the dispersant use guidelines quickly, as the Zone 1 area is the zone in which the Coast Guard had pre-approval to apply dispersants. This means that the Coast Guard, if in their judgment, they go through a decision matrix and make the determination that the dispersant would work, it's effective on the type of oil that we have, that mechanical recovery is not a viable option because that's the state's first position, is to remove the oil. Dispersing the oil does not remove the oil, it just puts it into the water column in smaller droplets. And then we also have other zones, the Zone 3 being one of higher resource value, in which we require the RRT's approval, which is made up of a consortium of federal and state agencies. And as Denny mentioned, we did go through a painstaking process in a very short order and did provide that approval, with some restrictions to protect the environment. The Zone 2 is an area in which is deemed that dispersants could be used. It would have less environmental impacts than in a Zone 3, but we feel that there's an adequate time for the RRT and the government agencies to decide whether or not that's a proper approach. So in a nutshell, that's where it lies. But the key point here is that the Zone 1 area, where most of the oil was for several days, is the area of pre-approval, and the Coast Guard has the opportunity to authorize the use of dispersants in that zone. And the Coast Guard conducted several tests with Exxon, and they made the determination that in the early tests, the application was not effective, and therefore, it was not approved. I might add that in one test, they decided that it was inconclusive, and therefore didn't authorize it. But they did eventually authorize it for full scale on Sunday, and it was until the next day, over 24 hours later, before application was conducted. Thank you. I'll answer any questions later.
That was Brad Hahn of the Department of Environmental Conservation. Here is Commissioner Kelso once again.
Thank you, Brad. Well, we have the zone map up here. Why don't I ask if there are any questions? I want to be a little bit careful. We don't take too much time, though, because...
This really boils down to, again, a matter of readiness in the face of disaster. Exxon did not have the chemicals on hand in order to use the dispersants when they actually could have done the most good, correct?
Well, Exxon certainly had the problem of needing to move equipment and materials like dispersants into the area. And if dispersants are to be effectively used, they need to be used when the conditions are right. What we like to see is a rapid deployment of mechanical containment and recovery equipment, and then the use of dispersants in selected applications. I guess the concern that we have about the information that had been offered by Exxon was that it gave the impression that somehow the recovery operation had been impeded by lack of approval. There may have been difficulties with the equipment that Exxon had and the availability of chemical dispersants, but really what we're looking at here is the initial response using mechanical means and the follow-on using all the tools available. So we're even now what we're looking at is situations where there is potential for mechanical recovery. We're encouraging that. We're not ruling out other tools either, but the opportunity really for dispersant use has passed because of the change in the consistency of the oil.
Dennis, you guys keep going over this. Isn't it true, after all is said and done, that pre-approval is simply not an appropriate word for the use of this stuff, even in Zone 1? When this stuff hit the water, there was no alarm that went off that said 10 million gallons of oil are in Zone 1, hit it hard, hit it fast with dispersants. In fact, there's all these riders, are there not? They have to do tests first. Whoever the agency is that makes them do the test, aren't you ready to say now to the public that the word pre-approval in that contingency plan is totally misleading? This stuff is not pre-approved to be used?
I think you're mixing up some concepts here. We're not talking about the contingency plan. What we're talking about is the application of chemical dispersants in areas that are under the Coast Guard's jurisdiction.
In Zone 1, right? We've been told for a week that the use of dispersants in Zone 1 for an oil spill was pre-approved as part of the plan. But in fact, when they have to go through tests and get permission for each test and all that, then to say it's pre-approved is really inaccurate, is it not?
You're incorrect in that characterization. The Department of Environmental Conservation, which is the only group of folks that I can speak for, concluded all of its approvals, and they were in place at the time of the response to the spill. There was no further action for us to take. In situations where we observed problems, we requested additional considerations, additional conditions, for example, to protect herring, so that herring wouldn't have dispersants dumped on them inadvertently. But there was no further action for us to take. At that point, it's in the discretion of the Coast Guard's on-scene coordinator. And
from your point of view, but from the point of view of Exxon, Exxon did not have pre-approval to just go in there and use dispersants. Isn't that true?
Exxon needed the okay from the on-scene coordinator. The on-scene coordinator considers the likelihood that that application will be effective and other factors as well. But what I'm responding to is the implication by Exxon that the Department of Environmental Conservation, the state agency, had delayed them in the use of those dispersants. That is false. There was no way in which state decision delayed the use of dispersants or any other recovery or containment technique?
Just exactly what are you responding, to? Who said what?
There have been two occasions here during Exxon press conferences when representations were made concerning this matter, and there was another representation made on the McNeil Air report last night.
You're obviously very upset about this because you think it's a misrepresentation and an attempt for Exxon to blame someone else for their lack of response.
We're in a situation where we, all of us, Exxon, the Coast Guard, the Department of Environmental Conservation, the fishermen, need to have our sleeves rolled up and get about this. This is not a situation where a bunch of finger pointing and hiding the ball is going to be very useful. I was unhappy to hear reports that suggested that someone was looking for an excuse. And so, frankly, I think it's time to put that behind us. Let's forget the excuses. If we had a barrel of oil for every excuse that's been offered in this matter, we wouldn't have a cleanup problem. But we need to get about the business of going forward, and that's what my concern is. I want to close the book on this. I'm not going to say anything more about dispersant use after tonight. We intend to work cooperatively with Exxon and with the other entities, and we got a lot of work to do. We can still collect some of that oil. We can still protect some things. Let's not waste any more time on this other stuff.
Dennis, a couple of points, especially if this is the last time we'll talk about it.
Shouldn't have said that.
Is the cleanup plan, as it was written, did it consider dispersing in a spill of this size to be the principal way to clean up the oil?
In one portion of the plan, bear in mind that the plan has several different pieces, including a scenario, different scenarios for spill levels. And in the largest scenario, spill scenario, there was reference to dispersant use to protect bays and inlets. The thing that's important to remember about this situation is that for a long time that spill was in Zone 1, and so, or much of it was in Zone 1. But you also have to bear in mind that during that time it was not always susceptible for effective treatment with dispersants.
Very dependent on a lot of conditions, including the weather. Okay, and then the second point, though, and the one that interests me the most, is you're saying that even had they had carte blanche in their view to do it, use it whenever and wherever they wished, they had nowhere near enough dispersant then or 6 days later to do that kind of a job. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that during the time that, based on the information that Exxon has supplied to us and the application rate recommended by the manufacturer, which is Exxon, the application of this, well, Exxon is the largest manufacturer of it, and they have expertise in its use, and the 20-to-1 ratio is the one that is recommended. Based on that, during the first 24-hour period when it could have been most effective, there was only about 4,000 gallons available here. They moved additional amounts and hardware, the C-130s equipped to spray, to Anchorage, and as of 6 days into the spill, there was 110,000 gallons. Now, we're not suggesting, of course, that Exxon should have applied 500,000 gallons of dispersant, but given the impression created by their statements, I think we have to examine whether there was actually the capability to carry out what it is that they're suggesting they were slowed or prevented from doing by approvals.
Thank you.
Commissioner Dennis Kelso of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Come to the mic now is Brad Hahn.
About the pre-approval on the Coast Guard's part. The Coast Guard has a important task out there to make sure that the use of dispersants is effective. And there's several aspects on the use of dispersants to ensure that it is an effective treatment. Those include that the application must be applied to oil that is dispersible. It's not too thick of oil. The dispersant droplet size is appropriate, that the type of dispersant is appropriate to the oil, and that the age of the oil isn't beyond the point at which you can disperse it. As oil ages, it'll mix with water, and it'll turn into what they call emulsified oil, and the dispersibility of it decreases. Also, as oil weathers, it loses the lighter fractions, and weathering is simply aging of oil. As it's sitting in the water, it evaporates. The compounds come out of it that you smell when you gas up your car, those light compounds, and that reduces the ability of oil to be dispersed. So it's important that the Coast Guard has that approval ability to go out and observe the test to make sure that the oil can indeed be dispersed, because otherwise you could go out and be dumping thousands of gallons of another toxic compound into the water. And that's not what we want to do. We want to make sure that the application of these dispersants give us the effect that we're seeking.
That makes perfect sense, Brad, but in effect then, Exxon did not have pre-approval to use this.
That's exactly right. They don't have carte blanche. It's pre-approval from the state side. What the industry has said is that, you know, they would never commit to the dispersal as dispersing agents as a response action, because they felt that the agencies would never approve their use, because there is a lot of controversy over the use of dispersants. And so we took that step. We went through a very long planning process. It was an interdisciplinary, or agency, I should say, study, and came to these guidelines.
Can you show us on the map what are zone 1, 2, and 3 areas?
In the Prince William Sound area, this is the zone 1 area at this time of the year. This is at this time of the year, zone 2. Earlier in the year, it is a zone 1. It turns to a zone 2 from March 1, I believe, till the end of October. I'm not sure about the October date. It's either beginning or end of the October. And the reason that they have that date in there is to protect sensitive resources identified by fish and game, primarily the herring and salmon outmigration. I also should give credit to the other federal agencies that are responsible for managing those resources. They had input into it, too.
The areas to the outside of that then mean what?
The areas to the outside are Zone 3. And that area was deemed that it was had more sensitive resources in it, and that we should have time to consider the use of dispersants as an agency issue if a spill had occurred. And the reason they'd have time is because we anticipated, as it did happen, that a spill would occur near the tanker lanes. They're identified tanker lanes, and we assumed that it would probably occur in that central area. And if it occurred, we wanted to give the Coast Guard the opportunity to make that decision if the company wanted to respond with dispersants in a short order.
Brad, I'd like to ask something about the oil here in terms of the temperature. Today we were told that skimmers are no longer working and that it's taken on the consistency of black mayonnaise. Is this particular cold climate having any particular effects on the consistency of the oil that people did not anticipate the cold water?
No. We've had oil in the water up here before. It's a natural weathering process. The cold water does make it stickier or more solidified, but that's a natural process of oil and weathering, or aging, I should say.
Another question about dispersants. Someone was telling me that, and I didn't verify this yet, so I'm using this opportunity, that when dispersants are used, that there's kind of a peak bad effect right after they're used, because they release the most toxic components of the oil at that point. Is that true?
That's exactly right. When the dispersant hits the oil, you have to have energy to put it into the water column. And that's another key point that I left out when I talked earlier about the conditions that you needed. You need an energy, like a wave action. Otherwise, the oil will just float on the surface and not disperse out. When this energy is supplied, the oil moves down into the water column in a suspended state, very small droplets. As a result, you have an increased surface area, which means that you have a greater release of these volatile compounds into the water. and that's where the real concern lies. But tests have shown that in small applications, small being limited amount of oil, like 20 barrels is typically the test size, that this concentration is diluted out rather rapidly. But you would have impacts initially to organisms such as fish eggs and larvae that are floating, that are pelagic in the upper parts of the water.
What's the time frame on that? How long does that toxic effect, that especially toxic effect, last?
That would be dependent upon the conditions at the time. How much energy you have, how much mixing that you have. In the limited tests that have been done, you're looking at a time span of hours.
Question for you, Doug.
Thank you, Diane. Can I ask, are there any other technical questions for Brad first? Because we got to get this guy back to work.
Yeah, just one. Could you possibly expand on the claim that on Friday, part of the effectiveness of the dispersant couldn't be properly tested because the method used was ineffective?
Yes, I can. I wasn't here on Friday. I did see a videotape of that application. It was done with a helicopter with a sling bucket and spray unit underneath. And the problem with that approach is the wind off of your prop wash from the helicopter, or I should say rotor wash, I guess. And it results in inappropriate application of the dispersant. It's important that the droplet size is a proper size and that it's an even distribution onto the oil. In the film of the helicopter, you could see the spray being blown out and lots of different size of droplets, it appeared.
Isn't that something that should have been known?
It was known.
Why did it happen?
They were doing it as a test. I can't address that, but it was only a small-scale test. They wanted to look at the 95.7 dispersant, that type of dispersant, and see its effect.
I'm sorry, did you say it was known that the prop wash would have that?
Yes.
Was known.
Was it that it spread out unevenly? That was the problem?
That's my assessment of it. I wasn't involved in that decision process, but in general terms, it's best to apply it from a spray applicator that has real uniform nozzle sizes, and they make those that go onto boats as well as airplanes.
Could you take one more stab at explaining why Exxon would do that if they had? They should have known or probably did know that it would mess up the test?
No, I really can't address that. I think that they were just trying to get a first-hand look to see how it would work, and before they committed themselves into a very major project. And I'm just guessing and speculating. I myself didn't think that was a real inappropriate move, knowing that it would just be a real quick test, that you wanted to see how it reacted with the oil. You're not putting much down.
We certainly didn't have any problem with the idea of the testing, even where they were experimenting to some extent with the hardware. And it also should be borne in mind that in one of the requests during the last week, we actually did approve an application in Zone 3 with conditions. So. We try to look carefully on a case-by-case basis, and I want to be really clear that our policy is not in opposition to dispersant use, but rather we like to have selective use of dispersant use, use of those dispersants in conditions that are most likely to protect resources and most likely to produce effective results.
Then in plain language, what are you guys going to do to help Exxon limit the damage to the environment? I mean, it appears as though the oil is seeping into the Gulf now, it's coming out of the Strait, it's going into the Gulf waters. It's almost as though Exxon has said, you know, let's delay this as long as possible until the most oil can get into the Gulf, and then we really don't have a problem at all because it's going to evaporate and fall to the bottom in the deepest waters. What is it that the DEC is going to be able to do to help stop the damage now?
Let me do two things. One is, tomorrow afternoon, Governor Cooper will be here and we'll be having a press conference, I think, at 2:30. And we'll have more to say specifically about what the state will be doing. We're working on some plans right now. Our position on this has been there is still recoverable oil. We need to hit that hard using the available equipment. There were, have been three priorities. One is to make sure that the vessel does not lose additional oil, and we support the efforts that the Coast Guard and Exxon have been making to move that oil out of the tanker vessel Exxon Valdez. We think they've been handling it appropriately. The second priority is to establish defensive measures to protect against invasion by oil in certain key areas where the presence of oil could be very devastating. Now, there are far more areas where that sensitivity exists than where we have the capacity to intervene. But priority number two has been the intervention. And that includes both establishing defensive fortifications, such as boom barriers, and also picking up oil, skimming it, scooping it, rope mopping it, using whatever tools, sorbent pads, whatever tools will bring some more of that oil out off of the surface and out of the water column and into collector barges where we need to have it right now. The third thing, but one that we think has to wait until after we have done everything we can to reduce the amount of oil moving around, is beach cleanup. But that clearly needs to hold off until the other interventions have been done.
The scope of the efforts, I mean, how much boom you're using, or how much boom you've ordered in, how much absorbent, how many people are out there, how many federal people, state people are out there?
Let me invite Larry Dietrich to come up here and give you the update. And with your permission, I'm going to get Brad out of here so he can get back to work. And I'm also going to ask Larry to be fairly brief and then ask him a few questions, and I need to get him out of here, too.
What's Brad's last name and title, please?
Go ahead, Brad, you go.
My last name is Brad Hahn, H-A-H-N. I'm acting as a science and impact assessment team leader here.
Now, Larry Dietrich is approaching the podium to take over the briefing. Larry Dietrich is the director of director of environmental quality for DEC, and was introduced earlier.
To start out, I'll give you what we know about what the...
Mr. Dietrich, could you spell your name?
It's Larry Dietrich, D-I-E-T-R-I-C-K.
Your title?
Director of Division of Environmental Quality for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Okay, I'll start out maybe and give you a little bit of an idea of where the plume is now. Our data continues to be the best data that I see, at least as to what the behavior and of the plume is. Our flight time is increasing substantially as the plume expands, and it's getting to be a very, very difficult operation to keep a handle on where this is going. We now run simultaneous plane routes to try to map this. In the early days, we were running three a day. You really do very much need real-time information to be able to know what this is going to do so that you can deploy what resources are out there and place them in the best positions. Nonetheless, the plume is down in this region now. There has been some come down Montague Straits. There is some out into the Gulf of Alaska now. And as you can see, Valdez is up here. And so the transects, and we're using fixed wings now, are substantial. We usually end up running one generally around this route and back, and another one, because we want to map it at the same point of time, so we try to have two planes in the air.
Square mile?
Oh, I don't have the square mile figure. I should have brought our maps tonight. We have, we are now putting these in a graphic fashion. Some of our computer people are portraying them, and the operating committee has adopted the graphics works that we have produced, and we produce a daily map now, and they are available. I'm sorry I didn't think to bring any tonight, but you can get them over at our office.
The farthest point that you have here, how far from the
spill? Oh, it's... I'd have to look at the scale. I don't have that right off the top of my head. It's considerable distance. We must be in the 90-mile range or something, I would guess. The computer calculates the square miles for us, and that'll be right on the on the plot map. The other people that have been doing mapping efforts, what we're doing is we're combining resources now. We've done some U2 work. There's been some IR work done and some other people using some other techniques. So Exxon, the Coast Guard, and us, all the mapping people are getting together now, and we're going to try and put this out on our one presentation. So,
what hamburger are the islands in terms of Montague and the islands to the west in terms of oil and death of animals and birds?
Okay, the heavily impacted areas are Naked Island area. This, what happened originally, the plume, it came out of the vessel, it kind of sat right in the middle of Prince William Sound, if you recall, for 3 days. Then we had a storm, it moved 37 miles during that storm, came over here, impacted Naked Island. There was a large bubble that came through the pass between the lower part of Naked Island and Point Eleanor, and went up into Night Island Passage, and that was kind of a downside because it introduced it into a new area and kind of added another dimension to deal with that was very difficult. The upper part of Night Island is very heavily oiled along the shorelines. Lower Passage, Herring Bay, Upper Passage, and Northwest Passage all have accumulations in them in the coves. There's a stream that's coming down this way, down Night Island Passage. I believe the information, it's almost down in this area now, down by Dryer Bay. Smith Island is heavily impacted. Applegate Rocks and Seal Islands, these areas are all fairly heavily impacted. The plume today, we had some changing winds, and we've got some material going over this way now, over towards Hinchinbrook. And there's some concern about this area now. Some has gone out in the Gulf, and so it's gotten much larger, much more difficult to contain or do something with, less concentrated, so it's more difficult to collect or clean up recoverable product that is on the surface now, simply because it's less efficient as it spreads out. So,
are there a lot of dead animals and birds in those islands?
Yeah, I guess the new information is that it's coming yesterday is that some of the real impacts from the oil are starting to show up now, and that does include some of the mammals and birds, and there's a lot of people out there now doing some survey work. There is a rescue bird collection center set up in town. There are some numbers you can call now if you do see any stricken wildlife, and the resource science teams are positioning themselves to do what they can and take counts and so forth. As far as what's going on, the Esther hatchery remains pretty good shape. There were still some sheens up along the Lone Island area. Main Bay and the Ishami Bay here, this is Ishami, and Main Bay still are in pretty good shape. This Main Bay has a very long boom deployment, but they're still holding, and most of the stuff seems to be coming down this way. There is oil down into Latouche in the Port San Juan hatchery area. Most of the resources have been marshaled down into this area. We have deployed all four of our seiners that we've contracted with, and they're in this area. I didn't check before I left. I think we have three or four booms deployed down there. Our boom deployment specialists who we have under contract have positioned these, and we've fortified and done about as much as you can. And hopefully this will be good enough to divert that down Latouche Passage is our goal there.
Has any boom actually deflected oil at this point around the sensitive areas? Oil actually hit the boom and been deflected?
Well, yeah, we're hoping. We had one deflection boom out here and it failed. These booms are very difficult to maintain with changing tides and currents. And so they're very sensitive. You got to be on them all the time to keep them lined up. But to my knowledge, and I think there's a Cordova guy out there that could help me, but are we still okay at Port San Juan?
Yeah, it looked like there might have been a problem last night. The winds and tides appear to have
freed that area up for the time being. It's
actually reach the booms? Or?
Not to my knowledge, no, it hasn't gotten there yet, okay?
Larry, how much of a role are the Cordova fishermen playing in this containment effort? Are they the backbone of this effort, basically?
Yes, the Cordova Fishermen United is who we've teamed up with, and indeed it is their vessels at Esther Bay, Main Bay, Ishami Bay, and Port San Juan. We have chartered four of them. and it is mostly fishermen. There are some financial arrangements in place, I believe, now with Exxon for costs. We've used primarily used our boom deployment experts that we have under contract to lay these booms out, provide technical assistance to the fishermen, and do a milk run, if you will, to make sure they're maintained and in place. Right now, the skimming operation that was up here and our contractors are all down in this area here. We want to test this thing out. As you can tell, this is downstream from where a lot of product has to go yet, so we want to make sure this is good, so we'll be watching this for a long time because it will need to be in place for a long time.
Larry, I was out there yesterday, and I have two questions. One, what one of the fishermen was telling me is the problems they were having, they were really glad to have the experts down there to help them with the boom, but the problem was, like some of the stuff that we dropped off, it's different. Like some of the boom will not attach to other boom. There's different types and different makes, and they're having a really hard time. We also brought down, I mean, they looked good. I mean, it was secure. So my question is, one, how much problem are you having with the boom that's coming in from all parts of the country or whatever, deciding which boom goes where? And then there was some talk of log booms somehow to tie logs together to deflect oil. Is that a no now, or are they still thinking about log booms?
No, there's everything conceivable has been brainstormed. Right now, I don't believe there are any log booms in place right now, but the boom deployment specialists that have put this material out have had some difficulty because of the matchup, and that's because the sea curtain and the boom, the skirted boom material, which is, you may have heard, it's referred to as hard boom. And there may be some confusion between hard boom and what they call sorbent boom. The sorbent boom, if you see it around town here, is the sausage boom. It's kind of got a netting on it and looks like a bunch of cotton inside. The idea of that material is it absorbs the product. The skirted boom will have it floats on the top. It'll usually be yellow or red. I think there's some red stuff out there. It's got a big skirt that hangs below the surface. It's a lot heavier. And you put that out, and it actually stops the product from going to the other side of it.
Holding it down on the bottom?
Yeah, it's pretty rigorous. They have to be anchored out, and they might have a boom or a vessel on one end holding it. It depends on how it's deployed and what they're trying to do. Yeah, but the reason there have been problems is we were grabbing every piece of containment boom possible. We lost one day with a sky crane. We've been moving the boom. Everything's been moved down to San Juan with our... with the state sky crane. We finally got it in there in time, and in the process of doing that, wherever there was available boom, we took it regardless if it matched or not, hoping people could jury rig it. As more containment boom comes into town now, we've sent it down and are taking, you know,
So what's the kind you need mostly now? Is it the skirt boom is the most important, or both of them are important?
Oh, yeah, we need both. Generally what you do, you put the skirted boom out front so that the oil impacts it, and you put the sorbent boom behind it.
It's a flow chart on money. I mean, who has the money? Who's at the very top with the cash, and where does it go? I keep hearing from the fishermen that they can't get money out of Exxon, and it seems very confused. Who's got the money, and how does it get to where it needs to go?
We brought the money situation up with the operating committee because the fishermen have initially come over here of their own accord with their own vessels, with their own fuel and food. I believe it will be successful. The appropriate financial arrangements will come into place. They just may not all be there yet, but I think we're confident that they will be.
How much are we talking about for this part of the fishermen being over there and trying to get set up?
Oh, I don't know what the like a daily cost total.
Yeah.
There's probably, I don't know, maybe 20 vessels.
At least 20 fishing boats, maybe a few more at Port San Juan Hatchery, which is identified as the main priority, and maybe
35 to as many as 35 or so, perhaps in various places. That's just off the top of my head. We've got more we could take out, and we're prepared to.
There's more coming all the time, and.
Larry, you're talking about the hatcheries as the priority. What can you tell fishermen about the herring season?
I understand there's a fairly strong debate going on right now about a herring opening. There are herring in the area, and that was one of the concerns with the dispersant drops. We actually had, we believe, a false request for a dispersant drop in this area. The Green Island Montague area is a very extremely sensitive area. The fishermen and government resource people all believe that this is a very high priority. This is also a Zone 3 area. So there was a big black pancake spotted. I think this was on the first request we had for a Zone 3 drop. It was spotted up here. It was headed, everyone believed, down here. Request was made for Zone 3 drop. We had one of our observers had been out about an hour before that, had been down here, did not observe anything here. There was a very rapid turnaround given on the approval. The C-130 was deployed. They got down in the area, and the pancake was not there. We have since consulted with herring spotters and come to find out with their professional eyes that this was probably a herring school, and there are other herring schools. And so there are herring in the vicinity, and they are observing and locating these around the slicks. So
word from the DEC, I mean, best advice, let's say I'm a fisherman and I say, you know, hell, I want to go do herring. It's supposed to open tomorrow. What would you tell me?
Our best advice is to call the Department of Fish and Game.
Can you tell us on this chronology of events?
I would like to clarify. The Department of Fish and Game has the authority in that. I'm not meaning to be that flippant.
Will they listen to a recommendation from you? I mean, will they consult with you before deciding?
Flippant.
Will they listen to a recommendation from you? I mean, will they consult with you before deciding whether to open? I mean, is
probably
the hearing season going to start tomorrow?
They would. They do consult with us about current conditions and likely distribution of the oil, but they have the expertise to evaluate potential impacts on spawning herring, and they've been actively working on this for the last couple of days. They've also been pulling together a proposal for some long-term research on impacts on fisheries. So the Department of Fish and Game clearly has that expertise and is the right agency, and if you'd like to have us help you get in touch with the right person there, we'd be happy to do that.
I guess what I'm just wondering is, to your knowledge, will the herring season open tomorrow?
We don't have information about that.
Can you just clarify on this chronology of events, which of these approvals was for the pancake that may or may not have been the herring run?
Well, that was the first Zone 3 request, so whichever one that is on your sheet.
Also, can you tell us any more about the use of the unapproved use of dispersant in a, I forget whether you said it was a Zone 2 or a Zone 3 area? And the spraying of Coast Guard personnel?
Yeah, there was an incident on the vessel that the Coast Guard advised us of. Dispersant use in Zone 1. Yes, sir.
Yes, I talked to a spill worker today, and he told me he went out there, you know, left at 6 o'clock this morning, and he was headed to Smith Island, and it was too foggy to work, so they turned around and came back. There was two busloads of workers that didn't do anything today. Was that the case all over the affected areas? Was it too foggy to work today?
I think that we don't have information about the crews you're talking about, since those would be, I presume, Exxon employees, or Exxon contractors. The folks that we have in the field are already on site.
Well, was it?
We did have.
Was it too foggy there?
We did have a fog and snow problem in some of our early mapping flights, but those are back on track by the end of the day.
So you didn't.
More information. Didn't we have any fog trouble down?
No, we had flights out today, and we had people out there today. So I.
Well, they didn't even let them come to the island. They said it was so weathered. Smith Island was so weathered that they couldn't get in. They wouldn't let them dock. So I'm just curious if you knew if the weather was pretty bad out there, they didn't have much work to do.
I believe I'd have to check, but I'm pretty sure we had people on Smith Island.
That's the island I'm speaking of, Smith Island. They couldn't get on it.
Yeah. Well,
two busloads, 60 men.
Mm-hmm. Are you making sure it's or not? It's just an area?
Sheen's pretty far over.
But
so. No.
For that area over there is sensitive to what the most?
I understand. I have to check with the resource people, but this is all a very sensitive area. I mean, the Copper River Flats and the sea otters, substantial rookeries, shellfish.
Does DEC have a realistic appraisal of whether you think the oil will get around as far as Seward and Kenai, and when that might happen, or how much might reach those areas?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think in talking at the operating committee meeting this morning, Exxon is in contact with the Institute of Marine Sciences in Fairbanks. And fortunately, the institute up there has some of the best experts in the world on Gulf circulation patterns. Dr. Royer, I believe, and they're in the process of consulting them. They've actually have a history of current readings out here from deployed current meters. So there's a fair amount of information about the Gulf circulation patterns, and the behavior of that plume out in the Gulf is probably much more predictable than up in the Sound. So that's being looked into now, and they'll probably model where it might go.
If I could take two more questions, and I'd like to get this guy out of here.
How recently was the information you had on the Sheen being near Hinchinbrook?
This afternoon.
I was talking to some scientists who took over flights this afternoon and said that the Sheen that had been seen earlier was nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, I hadn't had a chance before I got over, since these flights take so long. Our people, when they get back, we immediately map it. And I don't have the information from our end of the day flight yet, but I'll have that as soon as I get back. And
can you ask before how many feet of boom you got out there? How many people you have working out there?
Well, we've probably got on our four vessels alone. We got two skiffs, two-man crews each skiff. There's four, a captain and a mate, two DE's observers, a captain. We probably got about 40 or 50 people on our vessels. I'd have to stop the. We've got some maps over at the office that's got all the vessels plotted and stuff, so I can count boats and people. I just have to work that up. But like I say, 30, 40 vessels somewhere in there. We've got 4 and 50 people, plus X number of fishermen.
Is the boom that you're talking about the same boom that Exxon talks about? I mean, when Exxon says there are X 100,000 feet of boom deployed, is it the same boom?
The only boom that's deployed right now is around the vessel, okay, mouth to Esther, Main Bay, Ishami Bay, Port San Juan.
Right.
The total lineal feet of boom right now, I'd have to.
Exxon gave a figure yesterday night for a total amount of boom deployed. Are they counting the same boom that you guys are working with? That's what I'm wondering. Or do you have your own supply of boom that's not counted in their figures?
Well, these are the only areas where boom is deployed.
Maybe you're not understanding my question. Are you guys getting boom separately from Exxon that has nothing to do with their boom that they wouldn't count in their figures?
Yes, we've obtained quite a bit of boom. We brought boom in from our Juneau office and what we had in our Anchorage office. We've obtained boom off the North Slope. Exxon has contributed boom. We could sit down and actually get the total at these sites and break it out as to who's contributed. Exxon does have some. We have probably... we have quite a bit, and break that out if you want.
Yeah, can you say how much is deployed?
I'd have to add that up. The other booms, the actual sea curtains that are in use right now, are those with the skimming operations that are going on. There were some in Herring Bay, and that's where you use a boom to pull between two vessels and snare the oil. And so there's some skimming operations and boom associated with those operations.
Is there a shortage of boom? I understand some boom that was headed for the Needles was diverted to San Juan.
That's correct. That's because the deployment at the Needles, which is right here, was too difficult. They couldn't successfully deploy it, so it was brought back. There was a run made out here to try to attempt a V boom, try to make a V pattern above Needles to deflect it around, and the currents and such wouldn't allow that, so we brought it back to San Juan.
This is a surge of boom. Could you use more?
We're in pretty good shape now for boom. In the beginning, it wasn't, but we've continued. Everything comes in, we've taken out by sky crane. And everybody seems to feel pretty comfortable now with what's at San Juan.
I need to let Larry get back to work, and I know you can appreciate that. We'll try to make them available to you again. And I want to also say that these are complicated issues to follow, and if members of the press need further information, need to talk with our technical people, please give us a call. Barbara Holian is the public information officer who's here tonight, and We'll be happy to try to get you together with whoever we need to. Please bear in mind that our highest priority is responding to the spill. There may be some delays in getting you together with the right person. Some of our folks have been out in the field continuously for many days now, so. But we do want to help you get that information, so let us know.
Thanks very much. Have you responded to the Soviet offer to help you? Have you responded to the...
And that were the concluding remarks by Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, Dennis Kelso. This DEC briefing covered a fair amount of ground. Evidently, the main motivation for the department was to clear the record on the ongoing question that has plagued at least the press corps about the use of chemical dispersants. A clear statement made by Commissioner Kelso was that DEC, the Alaska State Department of Environmental Conservation, did not prevent the use of dispersants in Zone 1 on the first 3 days. There was some additional discussion about dispersant. One point that was brought up was the observation that Exxon did not have the dispersant on hand to use chemical dispersants as the number one response. Or the first line of defense, if that has, as there are evidently some indication may be the case in the contingency plan for a spill of this size. Exxon itself, who manufactures the dispersant being used, recommends a 20-to-1 ratio of or one part dispersant, 20 parts oil, and in a spill of 11 million gallons, that would require 500,000 gallons of dispersant to approach that 20-to-1 ratio. On the first 24 hours, there were 4,000 gallons of dispersant available in the first critical 24 hours when the oil is most the most responsive to dispersant. And by the sixth day, there were only 110,000 gallons of dispersant available. However, after having made his point, Commissioner Kelso clearly expressing some dissatisfaction that Exxon seemed to be in a couple of press releases and on McNeil-Lear report seeming to intimate that the state had some role in preventing the use of a dispersants effectively, having made the point that he felt that was misinformation. Commissioner Kelso then said it's time to focus on rolling up our sleeves and working together. But he did make his point, and he also added that if we had had a barrel of oil for every excuse we've heard, we wouldn't have a cleanup problem. Some other announcements that were made, a couple of acknowledgments. I think one that many folks, certainly in Cordova, will be happy to hear is that an acknowledgment by the DEC that CDFU is the backbone of the containment effort in the southwest Prince William Sound. That seems evident to those who have flown over the area from reports we have heard, and certainly was acknowledged tonight by the DEC official who is in charge of coordinating the state's part in the cleanup. There are some problems with the efforts going on. They talked about the helter-skelter delivery of booms, resulting in booms that were difficult to mate together, but things are getting sorted out. Fishermen are responding that they were appreciative of the help given by the DEC experts in utilizing the booms effectively. One big announcement made today is that made tonight was that Governor Steve Cooper will be back in Valdez tomorrow, and there will be a press conference at 2:30 Saturday afternoon. Here in Valdez, Governor Steve Cooper will be back in town. As you have probably heard if you're following statewide news, the state legislature is rushing through an emergency appropriation of $20 million that is to be administered by the State Department of Environmental Conservation. And we may hear what is to be done with that money tomorrow. We certainly should be hearing Governor Cooper's comments on the progress and perhaps get some new direction in planning and management of this oil spill response, now in concluding its eighth day. I want to thank KCHU staffer Lori Lee and the technician from APRN who's been helping us, Chris Podilek. They've been assisting here at KCHU, here at the Valdez Civic Center, back at the station. Jeff Brown and Tucker Spohr are on duty. I'm Dave Hammack. We'll be back tomorrow at 2:30 with the governor's press conference here in the Valdez Civic Center. If there are any meetings called earlier, we'll be here for those as well. Advise stations down the line to be monitoring their message systems and the AP. We'll do our best to get the word out. And if there are any special conferences, and again, 2:30, KCHU will be on the air. I'm Dave Hammack, and this is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.